I used to drive all over town for low prices, but now I let Walmart's incredible new Savings Catcher do the work for me. I just enter my Walmart receipt online and Savings Catcher does the rest. It compares the prices I paid for items at Walmart with advertised prices from other top stores in my area. And if Savings Catcher finds a lower advertised price, Walmart gives me the difference on an e-gift card. Now that's my kind of work.
Introducing Savings Catcher from Walmart. Go to walmart.com/savingscatcher for details. Eligible items only. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to the fastest growing radio station on the internet, Earnest Radio Network.
Is everybody in? Everybody in?
Change in your world, how to live your best life, and celebrating humanity's flaws and triumphs. It's Beaten Path with your host, Jane Hoffman.
Good afternoon. It's falling into evening with daylight saving times in Duluth, Minnesota. Yes, we're on a new horizon this week. I'm continuing my series on international relations theories on North Korea because I believe it's a deprived topic on Blog Talk Radio. And I might add, for anybody who is monitoring us, that a lot of the features on Blog Talk Radio are little-known actors and actresses, as well as people with sagging careers. So, BTR, do yourself a favor and once in a while put an unknown like me on in your best of BTR instead of people with sagging careers. Now, I want to talk for a minute about survival before I get to the next level. I have to give my client a pseudonym. I work in the disabled industry with a person named Evelyn, who has scars all over her body because she was abused as a child and she continues to abuse herself. In a sense, she's been in the survival mode since birth, and she still only knows self-destructive behavior. In the same way, Kim Jong-un, the son of Kim Jong-il, has that same mentality because he's only furthering the cause of his father. North Korea feels we in our hearts as Americans, 60 years after the fact, really don't know why North Korea fought so hard to preserve itself against the proponents of capitalism and democracy when the Americans fought over the 51st parallel years and years ago. It left one nation divided into two with two different ideologies. In the same way Vietnam was fought, yet their fighting strategy was better, and they overtook the Americans, leaving 57,000 Americans dead. They reunited their country under communism, and now we're doing trade with them, and we're at peace. We're actually not enemies, we're not allies either, but we've opened the door. So, all of these factors lead us to believe that we think we know more about North Korea than we do. But what we really don't know or won't admit is that they're just a standoff nation who doesn't want to be subjugated to American values in the same way that Iran wants to remain a theocracy and other countries. But somehow all of these countries, whether they're indifferent or not, many of them fall into the category of axis of evil. But we have to look at, we have to take it a step further and not just go with what the media says. So Hank Hulig and Jan Sikema are two political scientists. No, I'm going to get into their statistic analysis of balance of power theory, but before I do that, I want to read this other clause by this other major person. AFK Organsky is the person who coined the term the power transition theory. And in Western Europe, that was an easy place to analyze power because there was the Triple Entente, the Triple Alliance. That's where the nation-state ideology formed, and that's where we impressed upon it geographical divisions of other countries around the world. Where it was primarily the British and the French that carved up the world and set boundaries. It is claimed that a balance of power brings peace. We have seen that there were periods when an equal distribution of power between contenders actually existed. Or, you know, was thought to have existed by the parties involved. But really, with examination, reveal that these periods were the exception rather than the rule. Still, as we can see, closer examination reveals that there were periods of war, not periods of peace. And what I mean by that is, when it was like the Triple Alliance of Russia and France and England, I believe, or other contingencies in Europe, it wasn't just peace because it was balance of power, which there was in many cases. During the Austro-Hungarian Empire, before World War I, before that broke up, there was that contingency of Germany and Austria against England and France and Russia. But then there were times when the Germans made secret pacts with Russia, and they tried to get countries to turn their back on each other, just like when Bismarck made the Schlieffen Plan, that he was going to fight a two-front war against France and Russia. So in the 18th century, the last century of the period called the Golden Age of the Balance of Power, there were constant wars. But after the Napoleonic Wars in the 19th century, there was almost continuous peace. From 1815 to 1915, it was 100 years, and there was only the Crimean War in 1856 that interrupted that. The balance of power is usually given a good share of the credit for this peaceful century, but as we have seen, you know, there was no balance of power at all, but rather a vast preponderance of power in the hands of England and France. Because even when they weren't fighting on their own turf in Western Europe, they were colonizing and making imperial claims in other parts of the world. A local balance of power between France and Germany erupted into the Franco-Prussian War. And German miscalculations that her power balance that were probable enemies resulted in World War I, bringing an end to the century of peace. Well, there was a second reason, besides the balance of power that Germany started. They had only become a nation state in 1890, and by the time they developed their arsenal and ammunition, it was 1915, and that's when they wanted to flex their muscle. When Europe was at the height of nationalism, which actually started in 1648 at the Peace of Westphalia. So the flexing of the muscles and nationalism reached its peak in World War I, and then we still saw that kind of dominance aggression by nations all the way through the end of World War II. Now, why am I bringing up Western Europe in contingency with North Korea? Because I have to bring in two more factors. The relationship between peace and the balance of power appears to be exactly the opposite of what it claims. The periods of balance, real or imagined, are periods of warfare, while the periods of known preponderance are periods of peace. If that is true, the time to worry about the dangers of a third world war is not now, when the predominance of the West is so obvious, but in the future, when industrialization may bring the communist world abreast of us in power. I guess they could be talking about China in that case. Because China didn't have its industrial revolution. They're in the midst of their industrial revolution. They were practically an agrarian state all the way between the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they've just adopted new technology. Now, I'm going to jump down to Organsky's theory to the main core. He does say nations will not fight unless they believe they have a good chance of winning. But this is true for both sides, only when the two are fairly evenly matched. Thus, a balance of power increases the chance of war. So that's a good point, that if two countries are evenly matched, but one wants to become dominant, then it will go to war if it thinks it has a good chance of winning. Now, I think in North Korea's case, they could feasibly attack South Korea, but sending a missile to the United States, that would make them an enemy of the world. And you know that America would retaliate strongly. The danger of aggression is to be expected from normally a stronger nation. A powerful nation intent on maximizing its power is expected to press its advantage and make war upon its neighbors if it ever succeeds in achieving a clear preponderance of power. Here again, the facts do not back up the theory. Nations with preponderant power have indeed dominated their neighbors, but they have not been the ones to start the major wars that marked recent history. This role has fallen almost without expectation to the weaker side. Well, I somewhat disagree with that, and I'm going to use Russia as an example. For example, the two times Germany asserted itself, they weren't satisfied with their position in the world, and they believed that they were to be the rightful inheritors of Western Europe, kind of like when I talked on previous shows, when Saddam Hussein thought he was going to be the regional power in the Middle East, and he ascribed to that level. Well, Germany was not satisfied with just being a mediocre, medium-range power. They wanted the full controlling power. Otherwise, they would not have gone all the way through the Netherlands to Norway and taken on that geographical extension at such a... You know, they did not first strike their immediate neighbors. They struck Norway, which they thought they could easily overtake, which they did. They didn't try to they dominated France, secondly, and other minor countries. Now, in the fact of the matter, let's look to Russia, whose foreign policy has always been expansionism. Even though they control the Eastern Bloc countries after World War II, Russia has never been able to go as far expanses as they've wanted. They were cut off from the Dardanelles Straits by Bulgaria and the Western Allies. They didn't fare too well in Afghanistan from 79 to 89, even though the Taliban said they were fiercer fighters than the Americans. And they've been limited in power. Of course, they control the Eastern Bloc countries like Hungary and Czechoslovakia, but Russia has really never fulfilled their complete total world domination either. And there was probably a time where they were equally as strong as the United States, if not stronger. And yet the Cold War held both of those nations off, except for a few skirmishes, like that one plane that went down in the 60s, I think it was. I am taking a few breathers, so nobody freak out, okay? So let me just repeat this last thing, and I'll see if my audience agrees with me. Nations with preponderant power have indeed dominated their neighbors, but they have not been the ones to start major wars that have been marked recent history. This role has fallen almost without exception to the weaker side. The theory of the balance of power provides no possible explanation for Germany's action in two world wars or for Japan's attack on the U.S. It does not explain the two great wars of recent history. Okay, I'm going to get back to that in a minute, but I want to read this last part of the theory. We are now in a position to understand more clearly why the usual distribution of power in the world has not been a balance, but rather a preponderance of power in the hands of one nation and its allies. Okay, let me jump back a minute. When Germany entered both World War I and World War II, especially in World War I, there was no guarantee that the United States was going to get involved. So I believe that Germany thought they were the stronger power over France and England. Now Japan, they were just reckless when they attacked Pearl Harbor. They actually annihilated us at Pearl Harbor and took down most of our naval ships. But the fact of the matter is, Japan, with its landmass and small country, they probably knew they were the weaker country, but they don't care. They wanted to take the risk anyway, because having a military battle was part of their personal identity. Now, those two political scientists I mentioned earlier in the power transitions as causes of war, Hank Houweling, Houweling, and Jan Sakama, they wrote a book, and their book was called The War Ledger. In contradiction to the balance of power thinking in their book, Organsky and Kugler claim to have proven that major war is caused by the overtaking of the dominant nation through challenging world powers. This regularity would still be valid in the nuclear era. According to Organsky, nuclear weapons have no effect on deterring war. However, very serious objections may be raised against Organsky and Kugler's test procedure. For this reason, we have replicated their analysis with a different data set and a more appropriate test procedure. Their results show that the power transition hypothesis cannot be rejected. This result is obtained not only for top dogs, the three or four strongest nations, but also for a complete subset of major powers. The latter result is different from Organsky and Kugler's, finding that power overtaking is significantly related to war outbreaks between contenders, but not in dyads encompassing complete class of major powers. So what they do, what these people do is they take the power transition theory and the international system, and they arrange it hierarchically with conditions of preponderance or dominance associated with peace. So my question is what about nations that are never aggressive, like Sweden and Norway? Are those nations, even if they have a strong economy, like look at Finland with Nokia, or, you know, Germany, now that Germany's now been at peace since 1945, and they have one of the best technological industries in the world, as well as Japan. Are all these nations, and whether they're hierarchically placed or not, considered a preponderance or a dominant? What exactly does that mean? Because every nation I learned in international relation with, like the stag theory, is if the basis of defense in every country is the security dilemma. You have a military defense to solve your security dilemma, which means that you're always under the assumption that you might be attacked. Now, if it's automatically assumed that the United States as the super hegemonic power is going to keep people in check, and we do that by collecting allies and fortifying them, then it seems like in the last 10 or 15 years it's only been smaller rogue nations that have been challenging our authority. And I would not consider that abnormal, because once one nation gets to the top, according to most international relations theory, there's always going to be a challenger. And whether it's realistic, even if North Korea is the weaker country, is it even healthy? In my opinion, is it even healthy that the United Nations are always supporting the hegemonic dominant country? Or should they hear out the weaker countries to give a voice to everybody? Now, if anyone who listens to my radio show is going to think that I'm anti-American, I'm not. I'm just putting out things. I'm putting out ideologies that are just, go with the territory. Now, I want to read three of the factors that are involved with international relations theories. One's behavioralism, one's classical realism, and one's collective security. Classical realism is the basis of international relations theory. It's also called human realism, and it's associated with Morgenthau and other political science exposition of realism. And what he states, in which power pursuits propensity of states, is derived from the basic nature of human beings as power maximizers. Thus, this perspective holds that ideological as well as material factors may constitute powers, power over public opinion, and hence as social underpinnings. What that means is, if you're talking about realism itself, realism is the idea that each nation is going to protect itself. And I think the definition that I read was not very good. So I'm going to I'm not going to read classical realism. I'm just going to read plain old realism. Realism is a particular view of the world or paradigm defined by the following assumptions. The international realm is anarchic and consists of independent political units called states. States are primary actors and inherently possess some offensive military capability or power, which makes them potentially dangerous to each other. States can never be sure about the intentions of other states. The basic mode of driving states is survival or maintenance of sovereignty. States are instrumentally rational and think strategically about how to survive. So that is the basis of political science theory. Now, the fact that North Korea is vocal about that, see, part of their problem, like we discussed Sunday night, is brinkmanship. Because they're not like the other political science classification called liberalism, where kind of like where the notion of the state is to do good and to preserve the goodness of the people. And I'll just briefly read that. Liberalism is a political theory founded on natural goodness of humans and the autonomy of the individual. It favors civil and political liberties, government by law with the consent of the governed, and protection from arbitrary authority. In IR, liberalism covers a fairly broad perspective from Wilsonian idealism. They're talking about Woodrow Wilson when he created the first international organization, through to contemporary neoliberal theories and the democratic peace thesis. Here, states are but one actor in world politics, and even states can cooperate together through institutional mechanisms and bargaining that undermine the propensity to base interests simply in military terms. States are interdependent and are actors such as transnational corporations, the IMF, and the United Nations. So most liberal theorists in countries that back that type of theory, like Sweden, and Norway and Finland are, they believe in world cooperation. They believe in dialogue versus force. And a country like North Korea that's always bucking the system and refuses to cooperate, and yet I don't really know the size of their population, they're not taken as a legitimate global threat until they get the uranium and the bomb. Then they'll be forced to do that. Now, I read two definitions. I don't want to spend the whole show being clinical. But I would say that North Korea acts, if I were to attach a theory to it, it would be called offensive realism. And I'll just read you the, it's a theory built by Kenneth Waltz. Offensive realism is a covering term for several theories of IR politics and foreign policy that give analytical primacy to the hostile and unforgiving nature of the international system that causes conflict. Like defense realism, some variants of offensive realism build and depart from Waltz's neorealism. I'm not going to get into the definition of neorealism tonight. Offensive realism holds that anarchy, the absence of worldwide government or universal sovereign, provides strong incentives for expansion. All states strive to maximize their relative power because only the strongest states can guarantee their survival. They pursue expansionist policies when and where the benefits of doing so outweigh the cost. States face the ever-present threat that other states will use force or harm to conquer them. This compels them to improve their relative power positions through arms buildups, unilateral diplomacy, mercantile theory, which is economic strength, foreign economic policies, and opportunistic expansion. Ultimately, every state of the international system strives to become a regional hegemon, a state that enjoys a preponderance of military, economic, and potential power as part of the globe. So let's compare Jong Kim Un or Kim Jong Un to Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez was able to use oil and his resources as a bargaining tool in the world. He even gave New York City residents free fuel during Superstorm Sandy. So he used it as a weapon of good and bad. But the thing is what are Kim Jong-un's bargaining chips? Does he have any? He doesn't have any diplomatic leverage. Every time something happens, like the North Korean journalists that accidentally crossed the border, they bully other countries and they try to flex their power, including the threat of death to those two reporters, in order to stage their show. Nobody really wants to deal with them, and yet they're a threat. And also nobody recognizes them for any natural goodness or cooperative efforts. So I'm sure some states still trade with them that I'm unfamiliar with. But the fact that they, that one line that I read, their pure expansionist policies are used even when they outweigh the cost. So they make it vocal that they want to attack South Korea and the United States, but it's not really for their advantage. It's just for the intent of destruction. So the reason I've been reading these is because, political science theory developed over a set of examining Western powers. And then what you do is you transplant those basic foundations and then you compare the geopolitics. For example, North Korea is sandwiched between Russia and an effective Western-style government in Japan. But they really don't. They don't really have a way to assert themselves because America's already dealing with South Korea and Japan, and Russia's kind of been in tow the last 20 years since 1989. So I'm not really sure who they would turn to in the case of neediness. So we're going to cover that at the next commercial. It's already 7:29, and I'll get to that in a few minutes.
This is Earnest Radio Network, the fastest-growing radio station on the Internet.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Cardinals have filed into the Sistine Chapel to pick the next pope. The election follows the unexpected resignation of Pope Benedict XVI. A new report shows the ongoing violence, massive population displacement, and damage to infrastructure caused by the Syrian conflict may leave an entire generation of children scarred for life. The UNICEF study marks the two-year point in the Syrian crisis. Many children face sharply diminishing hopes for productive lives. The report also shows 1 in 5 schools have been destroyed, damaged, or used as shelters. 5 American service members were killed after their helicopter crashed near Kandahar City in Afghanistan. NATO says the crash is under investigation, and initial reports show no sign of enemy activity. The latest casualties made yesterday the deadliest so far for American forces this year. A new report out today shows America's schools are in major disrepair. The study by the Center for Green Schools says it would cost an estimated $271 billion just to get elementary and secondary buildings back to their original conditions. The report also says it would cost $542 billion over the next 10 years to bring all schools up to date. 2 space launch workers remain hospitalized after they suffered serious burns following an electrical explosion at Vandenberg Air Force Base on the California coast. The United Launch Alliance, a company that launches spacecraft for the U.S. government, says the 2 workers were transferred to a Los Angeles hospital that specializes in treating burn victims. Officials have not yet issued details on the cause or circumstances regarding the incident. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. Seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again. Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. Just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way. Whoa, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. Seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I could not find a friend, but I always thought that I'd see you again. Been walking my mind to an easy time, my back turned towards the sun. Lord knows when the cold wind blows, it'll turn your head around. Well, as I was time on the telephone line to talk about things to come, sweet dreams and flying machines in pieces on the ground. Whoa, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you, baby. one more time again now. Thought I'd see you one more time again. There's just a few things coming my way this time around now.
Earnest Radio Network, in part, is sponsored by Lakeview Towers. If you live in the greater Oklahoma City area and want finer living at a lower cost, check out Lakeview Towers at 6001 North Brookline Avenue. Since undergoing an extensive multi-million dollar renovation, Lakeview Towers has become the place to live in Midtown Oklahoma City. Spacious apartments with oversized balconies in this impressive 15-story high-rise gives you spectacular views of the city lights and beautiful Lake Hefner. A 3,000-square-foot family recreation room features a lounge and a large-screen plasma TV, kitchen, pool table, ping pong, foosball, video games, and a children's play area. Located near two premier golf courses, a huge shopping corridor, and the award-winning Integris Baptist Medical Center, Lakeview Towers has easy access to Highway 44 and Lake Hefner Parkway. Call them at 405-842-1438. Ask about their move-in specials, which includes your third month's rent free and a $200 American Express gift card. Enjoy life in Oklahoma City's most desirable neighborhood, Lakeview Towers. Their number again, 405-842-1438. The best place to live in Midtown Oklahoma City. And tell them you heard about them on Earnest Radio Network. You're listening to the fastest growing radio station on the internet, Earnest Radio Network.
Hi, everybody. It's Jane Hoffman, and I wanted to iterate. I found a relevant article that pretty much can be examined as, you know, I read an article where it said that all political theorists or major political theorists have predicted that the Korean War would rise, the sore spot between North and South Korea would repeat itself at some point in history. In other words, the armistice was never settled. So I want to read something about the rise in secondary powers, and then I'm going to go immediately to the current events article. So we know that when there is one dominant power, that, you know, other countries react in condition to that main power. A rapid rise in power produces dissatisfaction in itself. Yet at the same time, a rapid rise in power is likely to be accompanied by dissatisfaction. In the present period, such rapid rises have been brought about largely through industrialization. Rapid industrialization, however, produces many internal strains and grievances, and the temptation is great for the national government of a nation undergoing such changes to channel some of the dissatisfaction into aggressive attitudes and actions towards the outside in order to divert the criticism from government or other powerful things within the nation. So they're blaming the industrialization and those stresses on why sometimes nations become aggressive. Now, I don't see that in modern day Japan. A lot of those people work 10 and 11 hour days and yet they're functioning. However, now we're going to talk about the role of the challenger in international politics. The role of the challenger, of course, is not a permanent role, nor is it honed that all great powers go through. Some of the great powers never fill it. These are nations that are accepting a supporting role in the dominant international order, nations we have classified as powerful and satisfied. Dissatisfied powerful nations, however, are likely to become challengers, at least for a time. Now, you can see in modern-day Western Europe where the United States provides most of the security of the world for those allies, they can be powerful and satisfied because they're not spending 35% of their budget on military protection. And that's one thing a lot of theorists will complain about, that the U.S. does all the work. Now, North Korea could fall into the category of dissatisfied powerful nations that will become temporary challengers. Those who succeed become dominant and satisfied. So I don't think North Korea is ever going to become a dominant nation just based on their expression of dissatisfaction. Those who fail conclusively may fall back and accept a secondary supporting role in the international order they have tried to overturn, as Germany appears to have done after two defeats, thus joining the ranks of the satisfied and the powerful by a different path. However, as long as they remain outside the dominant international order and have hopes of overturning or taking over its leadership through combat, such nations are serious threats to world peace. It is the powerful and dissatisfied nations that start world wars. Well, I don't know if North Korea is capable of starting a world war, only if they had the uranium. So in the New York Times, which was produced today, it said South Korea said on Tuesday that North Korea cannot unilaterally nullify the 1953 Korean War ceasefire, calling the North's war threats a psychological ploy to strengthen Kim Jong-un's leadership at home and force Washington and South Korea to make concessions to the isolated country. During the break, I read that North Korea has no allies. So that's why they're often called isolated. Following through on a standing threat that it revived last week amid tensions over joint U.S.-South Korean military drills coupled with U.N. sanctions, North Korea declared the armistice nullified as of Monday, which is yesterday, and that the guns of 1953 the 53 Korean War silence for 60 years under an uneasy truce could roar any time. North Korea also severed military and Red Cross hotlines and issued a torrent of threats, including a possible preemptive nuclear strike against the two countries I just mentioned. In North Korea, the authorities were kicking up a war fever, a tool of populist control they had previously used at times of international tension. Remember last Sunday when we were covering this topic, they intertwined their domestic control of their citizens with pomp and circumstances of war. And this time they had their own people evacuate into tunnels with emergency provisions and putting up military camouflage on buses and trucks, which was initiated by the South Korean Defense Ministry. Well, I don't know. I think North Korea was doing that to them. But the South Korean defense must have been spying on them. Mr. Kim, the North Korean leader, visited frontline artillery units twice in the last week, warning that war can break out right now and calling for merciless strikes at the South Korean marine bases he watched across the borders through his binoculars, according to North Korean media. I am going to read that. This is a long article, but I want everybody to be aware that there are 28,500 American troops at the American bases in South Korea. Now, to me, that seems like a high number, considering that the war ended 60 years ago. 28,000? That's a lot of troops. It's a small country, and that's a big, that's a lot of military personnel to be maintained in a country that size. Last Friday, Hyun Young Ikol, the chief of the general staff of the North Korean People's Army, visited the Truth Village of Panmunjom on the border, raising fears among some South Koreans that the North might repeat what it had done in 1996 by sending hundreds of armed troops to punctuate its claims that the armistice was no longer valid. Now, this sentence was confusing to me. Does that mean they just marched across the border, made an announcement, and turned around? Stressing their alliance against North Korean threats, the office of South Korean President Park Geun-hye announced on Tuesday that she planned to meet President Obama in Washington in early May in her first summit since taking office in February. The announcement came a day after the allies began their key resolve joint military exercises, which are in addition to their two-month-long full Eagle drill that began on March 1st. If this is a routine military drill, why is North Korea getting paranoid? A unilateral nullification or termination of the armistice is not allowed under its related articles and principles of international law, said Cho Tae-young, spokesman of the South Korean Foreign Ministry. We demand that North Korea withdraw comments that threaten the stability and peace of the Korean Peninsula and the region. Well, whether or not the armistice cannot be broken, I do think, I don't think the international community can hold an agreement between two nations accountable. Eventually, things change. And to me, that seems unrealistic. Martin Nasirki, a spokesman for the United Nations, which set Allied troops to fight for South Korea during the war, also told reporters that North Korea could not dissolve the armistice unilaterally. That means by themselves. Kim Min-seok, spokesman of the South Korean Defense Ministry, said on Tuesday that there was no sign of imminent nuclear or missile tests by the North or hostilities along the inter-Korean border. He said that rhetorical threats flooding the North's state-run media were aimed at putting psychological pressure on the South. Well, the question is what do they want? What does North Korea want? And these bully tactics aren't working. Through a series of political and military activities, North Korea is strengthening the solidarity of its people at home while using the Key Resolve and Full Eagle exercise as a pretext to threaten and pressure South Korea and the U.S. to change their policies. If they launch a provocation, we will respond more strongly and make sure they suffer far more. So with this statement, I think North Korea wants somebody to suffer. Now, do they just want the sanctions removed? It's hard to say. Jay Carney, a White House spokesman, said the U.S. was certainly concerned by North Korea's bellicose rhetoric, and the threats they have been making follow a pattern designed to raise tension and intimidate others. Duh. And Tom Donikin, the American National Security Advisor, told Asia Society in New York that the North's claims may be hyperbolic, but he added there should be no doubt. We will draw upon the full range of our capabilities to protect against and to respond to the threat posed to us and our allies by North Korea. Now, this is something I want to question. If a land army moved in on South Korea, we do have around 29,000 American personnel there plus South Korean army to fight back. But if it's something more complicated, like Scud missiles, the way that Saddam used them against Israel, or some higher technology, is America prepared and do we have counter offensive missiles right in South Korea to fight them? It would be nice if I had some military expert call the show because I don't have this information. I know we have plenty of defense mechanisms, but I don't know the techie stuff. Raising the fear of military clashes by threatening to scrap the armistice has long been part of North Korea's efforts to draw Washington to the negotiating table. North Korea demands a formal peace treaty to end the war as well as security guarantees from the Americans. It also direct talks with Washington for the perceived prestige it would bring the regime. So in my analysis, I feel like they feel isolated. You know, they feel they have no international recognition. They're unhappy with the initial peace treaty that happened 53 years ago. They've pretty much been on the same page. And even if they become the strongest army on earth, they have no way to really assert themselves. And if they do, then they're going to get immediate retaliation. So I see that their warlike behavior is part of their warring culture, but it's also a grave attempt of international recognition, like a child wanting attention. I'll read the last two paragraphs and then I'm going to conclude the show. As the crisis over North Korea's nuclear ambition has dragged on, some analysts argue that Washington should try negotiating a comprehensive deal that addresses North Koreans' concerns in return for the North giving up its nuclear weapons. But South Korean and American officials also suspect that North Korea would turn talks for peace into an endless haggling demanding the removal of 28,500 American troops stationed in South Korea and the reduction of American arms in the region. Okay, that's not going to happen, okay? With the way they're behaving, they're never going to get those demands met. Since the end of the war, South Korea has accused North Korea repeatedly of violating the armistice by sending armed spies across the border, infiltrating submarines in South Korean waters. I want to note, they actually killed 46 South Korean naval people a couple years ago, kidnapping hundreds of South Korean fishermen and still holding them there, and launching an artillery attack on South Korea Island in 2010 that killed four people. Now listen to this. Thousands of men from both sides, including many American soldiers, are believed to have died or remain missing. So who is doing the reporting on that end? That's something that's, you know, hidden, that most people don't know about. As of the mid-1990s, North Korea has violated the truce 420,000 times, according to American and South Korean military data. North Korea alleges more violations by its enemies. Until recently, it has routinely accused them of sending spy planes into airspace and bringing heavy weapons into the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, along the border than is allowed. So, I don't know. To me, it seems like I don't know how to frame this, but it's a permanent hot spot. And it's also unresolved. And going back to my article earlier in the show, North Korea is a dissatisfied power. No matter how much, you know, recognition they get, they're a threat because they're dissatisfied. And the article states, it is the powerful and dissatisfied nations that start world wars. Now, because everything's speculative and we don't know their capabilities, we can't really measure if they are a contending or equally matched nation. All we know is that they continue to raise threats, and nobody's really factoring in the security dilemma. In IR theory, the security dilemma refers to a situation where two or more states are drawn into conflict, possibly even war, over security concerns, even though none of the states actually desire the conflict. Essentially, the security dilemma occurs when two or more states each feel insecure in relation to other states. None of the other states involved want relations to deteriorate, let alone for war to be declared. But as each state acts militarily or diplomatically to make itself more secure, the other states interprets its actions as threatening. An ironic cycle of unintended provocation emerges, resulting in escalation of the conflict, which may eventually lead to open warfare. Well, in this case, we know that North Korea is dissatisfied. And we know they feel insecure, because who wouldn't if the most powerful nation in the world has several bases in South Korea? Maybe they feel threatened, but even though we make no orchestrations to attack North Korea, they still feel threatened. So with that, time will tell, history will unfold, and we'll find out really how powerful North Korea is. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'll see you next Sunday, and hopefully we'll find a lighter, more happier topic to discuss. Until then, don't get nuked.
This is Earnest Radio Network, the fastest growing radio station on the internet.
You haven't been listening to Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker? Here's a little sample of what you've missed. The closest thing you can get to the DMV of the financial world, for my money today, is Bank of America. I'm making the biggest purchase of my freaking life, and you're the one I'm trusting? Mr. Magoo of the lending world, who can't keep my paperwork and keep track of it for more than 10 minutes, I'm trusting you with my loan? Holy crap!
All that and more every Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific.
Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. Real estate. Totally unafraid. Find out everything you need to know at therebelbroker.com.
It's one of D.C.'s biggest killers.
But I'm fighting back.
But I'm fighting back.
But we're fighting back.
Colon cancer is 90% preventable.
If properly screened and detected early.
Get tested.
Get tested.
If you're over 50.
Or have a family history of cancer.
Set up a colonoscopy.
Set up a colonoscopy.
Or log on to chrisforlife.org for all the details.
And get on with your life.
Get on with your life.
Amazing.
Fantastic.
Organic. Growing. So many words describe Earnest Radio Network in 2012. We have you, our loyal and new listeners, to thank for all of that. As 2013 is right around the corner, we're excited for all the new things we have planned for your listening pleasure. We've streamlined the times of all of our shows to 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, except Saturday edition, which is always at 6 p.m., 5 Central. Some shows ended, but we added Beaten Path, a new show by Jane Hoffman on Tuesdays, talking about how you can change your world. Come get inspired by history and find your present. Jane is also here on Sundays with Political Gravity. Music Monday still houses the best in independent music out there, one album at a time. The Earnest Experience radio show is still on fire every Thursday as well. We've revamped our site and finally got ourselves on Facebook. You can keep track of all of this by visiting earnestradionetwork.com. Thank you for listening, and let's get back to the show.
You're listening to the fastest-growing radio station on the Internet, Earnest Radio Network.
You just heard the fastest-growing radio station on the Internet. You can find out more by visiting earnestradionetwork.com. Please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/earnestradionetwork. Follow us on Twitter at Earnest Radio Net. Our email is earnestradionetwork@gmail.com. All content on Earnest Radio Network is copyright 2013. No part of this program may be reproduced in any fashion without express written permission from Earnest Radio Network. Thank you for listening to the fastest growing radio station on the Internet, Earnest Radio Network.
This is Earnest Radio Network, the fastest growing radio station on the Internet.